Christmas and social justice, Christmas and social responsibility. What can these things really have to do with each other? There seem to be two Christmases that America celebrates. One of them is very sentimental, and it pictures a Dickensian world of snow and roast goose and family. It is a religious holiday also. And the other is this commercial festival of capitalism and of buying things that we don't need to give to people who have enough, and to celebrate all of these things that keep the economy going. It's part of the Ponzi scheme. And these two things seem to be at war in some ways with each other. And I don't think that they truly have to be. Christmas is extraordinarily simple and extraordinarily complex all at the same time. And I believe that it is rooted in social justice from the very beginnings of the stories, mostly as recounted in Matthew and Luke, picked up in our popular lore by Charles Dickens in A Christmas Carol, and then conveyed to modern times with what is often criticized as Capricorn sentimentality, but really isn't, It's a Wonderful Life. Now, when you put all of those themes together, you understand that we're dealing with something simple and complex all at the same time. Christmas is a birth story. It's a miracle story, and the miracle is not in the telling that Mary was great with child and that Joseph was not the paternal father and it's a miraculous conception. It's that every conception is a miraculous conception. It is that the idea, the phrase that so kind of repelled me for so many years because I was hearing it in a context that was not poetic, is love made flesh. Now, I'm going to do something that is probably not being asked in any other congregation in the United States, probably not even Unitarian congregations in Florida, and that is I want you to think about sex for a minute. Finally, you can listen to your preacher, you know? Finally, I can issue some request that has a good chance of compliance. It's remarkable. I mean, think about how it is that we transmit ourselves, how we mix the DNA. You can think about the act, you can think about the passion, you can think about, but think for a moment just about the biology of love becoming flesh, of our essences combining and forming a unique human being that thinks, that can learn to live, to love, to be human, to express itself. It's an everyday miracle. And if we were somehow some other kind of creatures and someone explained this to us, that this is how some other creature reproduces itself, we'd go, come on, get serious. I mean, which was pretty much the attitude I know that I had when I was 8 years old and someone explained the facts of life to me. And I said, I don't think so. And it is still a wonder and a miracle. And we sometimes just forget it. And so the miracle birth story is love made flesh. It is the miracle of incarnation, of joining of body and soul. You know, there are two creation stories in Genesis. Genesis 1, strangely enough, and Genesis 2. Genesis 1 is normally considered to be the newer and more Greek version, Genesis 2 being the older, where God molds Adam out of the earth like a potter. But a very great philosopher looked at this and said, just a second, no, it's about two different kinds of being. It's about spiritual creation, and it's about material creation. And the miracle is of the fusing of body and soul, that we become for a while alive, and that we transmit that life to others in DNA. We transmit that life and those values to others by example and by our efforts. That, to me, is at part of the beating heart, one chamber of the beating heart of Christmas. The other chamber of that beating heart, and I may not get to four, so we may end up with a reptilian heart for a moment. But the other part of that is, think about it theologically for a moment, what it means. Most of the time when people say the word God, they can't help but hear and picture somebody with a phony English accent, in a white beard, an old guy, a toga, a golden throne, in other words, Zeus, all-powerful, hurling lightning bolts, and we worship God, and we fear God, and we love God in traditional religions. But think about Christmas for a moment, where the Christian position is astonishing. God becomes a baby. God is incarnate in a child. God is not the big boss, but God needs people to tend, to protect, to nourish, to nurture. There is a point where it calls us to that creche in order to see the divine in every child, to see the divine that needs our nourishment, needs our attention, needs our gifts of time and of caring. It's an astonishing piece of theology, and it's one of the reasons why Christmas was rejected for much of the history of Christianity, one of the reasons that it is only briefly mentioned in both Matthew and Luke and pretty much ignored in the other Gospels, because the idea of the vulnerability of divinity seemed too literal to some people. But to me, it goes to the heart of what we are as human beings. If we cannot see the precious and the divine in a small child, what chance do we have of seeing it in each other? In older people, in prickly people, in angry people, in difficult people? What chance do we have of seeing the divinity in a teenager if we weren't able to see it in the baby? Now, that's a religious challenge, and you understand that all too well. Almost all of our religious traditions, Judeo, Christian, Muslim, Buddhist, Hindu, talk about the Messiah, the Savior, the Guru, the person who could make all the difference, who may come to you in the form of a beggar, or a madman, or somebody who is otherwise marginalized. And they ask us, they recommend, don't take the chance that when you see that old woman on the street, that she's just an old woman on the street. She might be the one who makes all the difference. She might be that person who, if given attention and given respect and given love, may change the world. It's a universal gamble, and it doesn't cost us very much to try to look deeply into the eyes of people whose gaze we normally avoid and evade, and look for the human, and look for the hope, and understand the relationship that we have. But it starts, I think, with our children. I mentioned last week that I had more calls from people in tears after the school shooting than I did after 9/11. It hit us at a very deep level because these were children. I mean, it's not that we would approve of somebody coming and slaughtering a bunch of adults, but there is something so primal in our DNA that we can lose it, we can forget it, we can stomp on our DNA and choose not to recognize it, but there's something so primal that calls to us when there are children involved. Afterwards, I was in discussion with several of our people who asked the question, and it is a decent question, which was, well, everybody was very upset about that, but what about all of the black kids who are dying on our street corners? What about all the brown kids who are dying in barrios? What about all the tan people in the Middle East in Afghanistan, in Iraq. What about that? And it's a decent question. And my response to it is this. We care, we should care, we must learn how to care, but love, for the most part, starts from the inside out, from the near, and expands our vision and our hearts to the further away. It doesn't normally, for most people, start out there with the perceived other and then work back. Because if we don't know how to love, how to empathize with those closest to us, and it can be physically, it can be spiritually, it can be blood ties, it can be any number of ways, but that we see in ourselves, that's how we grow our hearts. That's how we grow our souls, by reaching out and embracing the different, because we started closer to home. We learned inside out. I think that's part of the important message of Christmas. Another part of the important message of Christmas goes to what sometimes gets overdone in the commercialism, and that's the scene at the manger where you have shepherds, and the shepherds are there saying, the message of what you are called to do goes to poor people. The good news goes to, it's not chosen just for an elite. The shepherds are the first to get the viewing, to have the connection. And then the three magi, mistranslated as kings and never named in the biblical narrative, they are the magi of another religion. They're in that scene for a couple of reasons. They're in the scene because they want to communicate that this creche, this universal call to the young, to the child, is not tribal. It's not one group. It's not one religion. It's a universal responsibility to follow the stars of our values and to be present at the birth and at the and take the responsibility of nourishing and nurturing the future. There's also a dark side, and I'll get to the dark side, which is that the three magi are part of the slaughter of the innocents narrative. That they talk to Herod and say there's going to be a king born in Bethlehem, and Herod says, cool, let me know when you find him, so that he can go and kill him, because Herod is a very insecure guy and has a lot of reasons to be. Well, the three magi kind of get wind of this, so they go to the manger, they go to the creche, they give their gifts, and then they return home without going back to Herod. And as T.S. Eliot wrote, they returned to their kingdoms, no longer at ease with the old dispensations. Their hearts had been changed by the birth of a child, and by being brought to their knees, not in humiliation, but in humility, at the awesome responsibility that we have. They also brought gifts, and you know the gifts, gold, and everybody needs a little bit of gold, a little bit of money, a little bit of the beauty of the gold. But then there are two ambivalent gifts, frankincense and myrrh. They go two ways. One, they show kind of a need for luxury. They are aromatic resins. They're used in perfumes. They're used in incense. They add to the senses and to the spice of life. But they are also harvested in a very difficult and brutal way. The bark of these bushes is slashed with a knife. And the sap is, they actually use the word in Arabic, it's bled into the form where it then becomes the hardened resin. And as Eliot wrote in another poem, in my beginning is my end. We see in this part of the nativity narrative both the beauty of new birth, but we have the ending foreshadowed. We see in our heads, if we are culturally literate, both Mary, great with child, about to have this joyous experience of birth, and we see Mary, the Pietà, holding the body of her young child. of her young man. And we understand that there is the light and the dark. There is the birth and the death. There is the vulnerability and the hope and the engagement. All of these things brought together in this nativity scene, not at all by accident, but put together carefully, image by image, to be mined, to be interpreted, to be reinterpreted. I mentioned in the beginning It's a Wonderful Life, and people who look at that and say, oh, it's Capricorn, it's sentimentality, every time you hear a bell, an angel gets its wings. Watch the movie. It is an indictment of greed. It is an indictment of bankers who say, don't give that loan to Mr. Morales. Don't give that loan to to Martinelli. Don't give that loan. You're going to get a lazy and dependent underclass if you give them money to get homes. I look at this thing and it sounds like talk radio today. We have not advanced past Lionel Barrymore. And then you have the Jimmy Stewart character, who basically says of capitalism, if there's no competition, there's no real capitalism. If you only have that one big bank and not this little savings and loan, there's no reason to moderate Potter's behavior. There's no reason that people will behave well. And you see that gift that he has given of what the world would have been if George Bailey had not chosen to follow the call of his better angels. If he had not chosen to be the suffering servant who gave up his life of adventure and to stay home and do decent things for decent people, to see the humanity in others, to nurture their hopes and their dreams. It's a very subversive message. And it leads me to wonder if part of our religious theme of looking for that one inside that old man, that old woman, that beggar, maybe it isn't waiting for the one. Maybe it's waiting for all of us, that it's the many, and that the call to the creche, the call to serve values that are decent, is a deep call of social responsibility and social justice that is inherent in the nativity narrative. That we are all, from high degree to low degree, with whatever our gifts are, if it's gold or if it's frankincense, if it's just our presence and our acknowledgement of the miracle of life when we become present to each other in the miracle of life and become servants of examined values that bend towards justice, then we bring into the world the holy, the divine, by seeing it, by acknowledging it, by creating it. I remember a class that I took in Roman Catholic canon law. I was the only non-candidate for the priesthood ever to take this course from the Jesuits. And the Jesuit priests all thought I was quite mad to take it because they didn't want to be taking it. The canon lawyer, Father Richard Hill, introduced it by saying, well, boys, this is the bad part of the good news. And you look at how our religions try to involve us into how shall we live together. What is it that is justice? What are our responsibilities to each other and to our world? Most of us remember a brouhaha a couple of years ago when the carpet in the Oval Office on President Obama's carpet that he chose has five quotes. Two of them had turned out by our Unitarian minister, Theodore Parker, but one of them had been attributed not by Martin Luther King. He had used it, and he had attributed early, but the attribution had fallen off. And it was, the arc of history bends towards justice. And I think what Christmas asks of us is to be a part of bending the arc of history. To not assume that it's an automatic road and the ending has been written by some great God in the sky, but that we are all the eyes and the ears, the perceivers and the creators of the divine. We are all the people who are called upon not to worship justice, but to do justice. Tomorrow night, we're going to have a version of O Holy Night. It's an interesting song, almost everybody's favorite unsingable Christmas song, very operatic. And the second verse of it, and the words, the English words were written by a Unitarian minister, not Theodore Parker. It said, chains shall we break, for the slave is our brother. That's at the heart of the radical egalitarianism, the radical call to justice, to witness not as spectator, but to witness through service as our prayer to the future incarnate in love made flesh, beginning with small children.